Welcome in to another episode of Sociology Talk. Here we have Michaela Dorman, who was actually used to be one of my students at CCB AV. So happy to have you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so I like to start off the every episode with just an idea. I guess why is it that you decided to major in sociology?
Well, it's a little bit of a funny story, the journey that I took to get to sociology. It began in high school. I took a sociology class as an elective my senior year of high school so I could get to five classes, because they convince you in high school that you need five classes in order for colleges to look at you. So I took a sociology class. I really enjoyed it, but at the time I was also taking AP calculus and I was very into physics and mathematics. So I initially went to Antelope Valley College to play golf, and I was majoring in mathematics. But my first college calculus class just went horribly. The majority of us were people that were good at calculus in high school, or it was people from Northrop and Lockheed and Edwards that were going back to get degrees. And the majority of us ended up dropping that class. The day that I went in to drop the class, I said, you know what? I don't want to do math every day anymore. I'm over it. So I decided to change to sociology because at the time I really wanted to be a social worker. I had done this kind of info session that ABC did with DCFS and found out about emergency response social workers. I thought that would be something really cool to do. And I've always enjoyed learning about people, why they interact with each other in certain ways, why people act certain ways towards situations. And I learned a lot about it in my high school sociology class. So I decided to just keep going with it through college.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so what was it about the discipline, either the stuff that you learned in college or the stuff that you learned in high school? What was it that kind of drew you into, like, oh, that's really interesting? Was it like research stuff, or was it just kind of like certain everyday concepts that we're able to place on our experiences? Or
I would say the initial thing that made me think it was fun was in high school, my teacher, Tavion Bryant, that's his name, he is also a local kind of superstar. He is a paraplegic and he does a lot of hand cycling. I think he's done over 40 marathons. He's pretty popular out here for doing things like that. And he's a sociology teacher at Quartzsill High School. He had us do an activity in class where he split the class up into a group of, I believe there was maybe 10 of us. And he made us go outside of the room, unaware to what was going on in the rest of the class. And the rest of the class was basically given instructions to observe us as we came back in, and we were given a task to do. We came back into the class, we were given a task to do. It was something like, I believe it was something about us being on a ship that was capsizing. And we had a list of a number of people with different conditions, like children, people that were sick, elderly people, fit young men. And we had to order them in the order of most to least important for who gets on the lifeboat. And we had to figure out who was the most to least important people to put on the lifeboat. And the rest of the class had to sit there and watch us figure it out. And it was really interesting because then afterwards we all had to sit there and listen to the rest of the class talk about what they noticed of how we figured that out, our thought process, who took a leadership role, who kind of didn't talk that much. I thought that was really interesting. And then as I got into college at ABC, I actually got I forget what they're called, but it's basically like a department award in sociology at ABC through my golf coach. And my favorite professor at ABC, I took an American social problems class with her. And she made that class so interesting. And that's when I really started realizing that you can apply sociology to every social interaction that you see every day. And it's something that I actually use quite frequently in my job as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And it's such a I'd love to hear the ideas that different instructors have, and how that kind of helps students to really understand the discipline or the ideas. And I love the idea of role playing. Like, I need to include that more. And so, yeah, you had mentioned that sociology can be applied to like mostly everything, and it's so true. Like, any type of research that you do, you can explore it through a sociological lens, because we all have different experiences. And for me, I really got interested in the idea of technology and how technology kind of influences our behaviors, or how we tend to change the direction of the trajectory of how technology is developed. So it's really interesting. And so, I did it on like technology, Facebook. I had somebody else that was exploring like music and how different lyrics have certain meanings and stuff like that. So yeah, you really can do a lot with sociology. It just kind of depends on which area that you want to focus on, And so I didn't want to forget to bring this up, but I remember that you did some research as an undergrad. And it was very interesting. Like, the time that we had as a student and instructor, we had to do it in the midst of COVID. I don't think we actually even met in person until like your senior year or something like that. So it was like, it was very interesting and very bizarre, kind of experience for all of us. But so you had become fascinated with the idea of how students were managing, I guess, during the midst of COVID. So did you want to talk a little bit about like your project, like what you did, and maybe what you found?
I initially became interested by it primarily because I had so many friends at the time. The majority of us were doing school online. I even have friends in other states who were kind of being forced to still do school online, even though COVID was kind of ending. But I found that there was approximately a 50-50 comparison, at least to who I had talked to, of people that were doing really well. For example, myself, I actually found it more convenient because I was just able to do the work on my own time as long as I had it done by the due date. I wasn't restricted so much as I was my first semester because I really only had one semester in person of college. But I found it very difficult then, sometimes, especially also being an athlete at the time, to get all of my work done in a timely manner because I would only have 2 days in between classes versus once we transitioned to online, it was much easier for me. But I saw some of my friends struggling with it. I had friends that dropped out and have never gone back to this day because they couldn't handle the online aspect of it and they just started other careers or did certificate programs, went into aerospace, things like that. So I thought that was very interesting. And then I remember you gave us a copy of your research on Facebook to read. And I read that and I was like, okay, you know what? I should dive into this and how technology is affecting people. I started doing research on it and I realized that nobody's really done research specifically on how college students are affected by this transition to online. Most of it's on children, which is also very important for the social aspect of it, but it's also very important in that very early adulthood stage for most of us. So I interviewed some people that I know. One person was going to College of the Canyons at the time. Everybody else that I interviewed was going to CSUB. Some of them were also sociology students. I believe at least one of them was a business student. So, and the one that was going to COC was also a business student. So it kind of gave me a wider aspect, even in that limited time that we had, because the process was giving us such a difficult time. But I was trying to remember. Let's see. I do remember finding that at least half of them were struggling. At least half of them were struggling. They were having a hard time with it. Some people liked it because of, as I mentioned before, with myself, they had the freedom to do the work at their own pace. They were working, they could just do it at night if they wanted to. You could do it early in the morning. You could get all your work done in one day and have the rest of the week to yourself if you wanted to. Which is what I often try to do. I tried to be done by Wednesday every week, and I'd have the other 4 days of the week to myself. But there was also people that were really suffering in the social aspect of it. And I also found that myself, I really only made somewhat friends in college because I was working at the front desk at CSUB and I got to see people every day. Had I not been doing that, I probably wouldn't have made any friends or really met anybody. And I mean, come to think of it, that's the only way that you and I were able to meet in person was because I was working at the front desk. Had I not been doing that, I probably never would have seen you in person.
Yeah, for sure. And
But
I, oh, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
yeah, I don't know. I found it very interesting that there were some people that seemed to kind of enjoy the social aspect of it too, because it wasn't so much pressure to interact with other people in person.
Yeah, bunch of introverts like me. So that's interesting. So you had mentioned that you had some friends that kind of just dropped out, and my chair actually did some research on the effects of COVID on students, and I think the two major things that she found about why students were leaving but then also not coming back is that one of them is what they started like a family life like during COVID. And then another one was that they had to work. Like a lot of them had to go out and in the field and obtain jobs because it was for the sake of survival. You know, like lots of people were losing their jobs and, you know, the economy was doing horribly. And so I think those are the two major things that happened to students. Was that something that you had seen in your research, or was there something different that you were starting to see when it came to certain patterns about why students were not coming back?
I in my research, well, I only my research specifically, the paper that I wrote only focused on people
Oh, that's right.
that were finishing, but just in my own personal experience, the majority of my friends that dropped out, they didn't necessarily need to work. Many of them were still living at home with their parents, and they didn't have that necessity, or their parents were telling them that they had to work. They were actually encouraging them to go to college and get a degree. Most of them just couldn't handle the online aspect. Some of them just simply couldn't focus with it being online, or couldn't learn well without that live interaction with an instructor. And especially with some of the classes being completely asynchronous or even being pre-recorded lectures, it just didn't work for them. So some of them dropped out and then just never went back because they found something else that they're passionate in. Some of them went into aerospace, maybe even real estate. Some of them they did other things but didn't necessarily go back and pursue a degree. They just got a certificate or a license in something else, or found a place that they could work at and build a career at least for a short time without having to go back to school. And I do know there are some people that I went to school with who did drop out and start families and those types of things, and now they're just busy and haven't gone back. But the majority of the people at the time when COVID happened was the online was simply just too much for them.
And I'm the kind of person that's like, I mean, I've always been the kind of student that wants to be in the class, that wants to interact with the instructor, that wants to ask questions. And I know that some people do prefer like the online format, but I mean, my personal experience, and I know that people probably listening or maybe some instructors that are listening would disagree, would that be that the online structure of courses, I feel like it's just like not as great, you know? It's like I feel like you cannot get everything in an online class that you can in an offline setting. You know what I mean? I think that's and I think I felt this big time with theory. Like theory is very heavy, and just teaching sociological theory online was just very challenging, you know, for me. And I could see like a lot of students were struggling as well. And I think that that kind of course really requires a discussion. You know what I mean? Like, how do we understand these concepts? Like, how do I understand it with my own experiences or somebody else's experiences? And so we can have like a really good conversation about that in class. And I think that when you're in an online setting, at least, it's very difficult to do. I mean, there's some classes that are, Zoom accessible, and you can have conversations that way. I'm not saying those kind of classes, but the classes that are like everything is just kind of online. There's pre-recorded lectures, as you said. I don't know. I feel like students, it was kind of a disservice to them, I think. And I know that was like all that we could do at the time, but I totally get it. When students are just like, well, that's just not for me. Like, I'm not gonna go and take all my courses online, So yeah, it was definitely a bummer, and it was very challenging. And I understand on both ends, like as a student, having to suddenly switch over to remote learning is very difficult, very challenging. Also on the other end, with instructors having to kind of move everything when you've already planned everything to be online, now you have to place, or when you've already planned everything to be offline face to face, and now you have to suddenly move everything online, it was crazy, and I wasn't
Yeah.
to admit like, hey, I'm like struggling here. Give you some grace, and I also gave students some grace too, like I'm usually kind of like tough on like, oh, you have to provide a doctor's note. Like in the midst of COVID, I was like, if you're sick, you're sick. Like I'm just gonna take your word for it. I had a lot more grace, I think, when during COVID. But yeah, sorry, you were gonna say something.
Oh yeah. I remember you kind of sparked a memory for me. I remember when COVID first happened. I distinctly remember this. I was taking a U.S. history class at ABC, and my professor, basically a few days before they shut all the schools down, and said they were going to clean them for 2 weeks, and we would be back. He told us. He said, "Look, we're never going to see each other in person again. I know you don't believe me now. But watch, we're never going to see each other in person again." And I said, "But if you guys want to meet in like a coffee shop or something, we can do class. We just can't do it here." Nobody believed them. And of course, it happened. But I noticed some of my other instructors were very heavily struggling. My art instructor at the time, he was older. I believe he's in his late 70s, early 80s. He was having a very difficult time with the transition to online. I even had that second semester. I had some instructors basically tell us, "I don't want to do this anymore. We're advocating to go back in person with masks," and they're saying, "No. So here's all the answers to your test," or whatever.
Oh
They just kind of they
my
kind of
tapped out.
just they tapped out because they were getting really frustrated with it, or they thought that it was okay to go back. I mean, I even had an instructor say, "Look, I survived cancer. COVID's not going to bother me, but they won't let me go back in person. So if you fill out this study guide, you'll have all the answers to the test."
Yeah.
And you try to do things that way, which I do think in a certain aspect, specifically for test taking, I found it easier because I find a lot of the time when there's in-person tests and you're kind of forced to memorize all this information, you forget that information the moment that you bubble in the last question on the test. That
Yeah.
information's just gone because you were so stressed out about memorizing it for the test. It's not necessarily committed to your long-term memory. Versus when you're able to do activities like writing research papers or doing any other types of papers, that's for me personally when I retain the most information. So I found it very helpful that when COVID happened, the majority of instructors made their tests open book because they knew that people were going to cheat anyway. So they just kind of made it open book and let us have it. But they still made it very heavy on the papers and the essays and were simply just doing the exams because they had to. It was a, part of the curriculum or whatever it was. But I've always enjoyed writing papers, so that's the part that I looked forward to anyways, was doing the research and writing the papers. I never looked forward to taking the test on having to remember the year that something was created.
Yeah, and that's so true. I mean, and especially with like the age of AI, yeah, it made life a lot challenging for instructors. And then also, like you had mentioned, like some of them were just like tapping out. I notice, yeah, especially with instructors that aren't like really tech savvy, like they're just like hey, I'm gonna come in the classroom right on the chalkboard, and that's just kind of like my style, which, that's fine if that's your style. But to require them to now put everything online, like there's a learning curve, like you have to learn how to use certain softwares. Like I use Camtasia. I was actually fine because I kind of went to trainings and I was like aware of that kind of stuff, but not everybody did. And so now you're having to suddenly have to figure that out. So yeah, it's very interesting. So I can't remember if you were like human services or traditional track. Did you do like any type of internships or?
I did human services and my
Okay.
internship. I did it my last, I did it spring, right? Yeah, I did it one of the spring semesters. I did online tutoring through the Kern Literacy Council
Okay.
in Kern County. So I tutored an eighth grader in English on Zoom, and then I tutored an adult from El Salvador who was getting her GED.
Oh, interesting. And so that was your, so yeah, I was about to ask, like, how was it doing certain internships during COVID, right? And so it sounds like you did more of like an online work experience or something like that.
I did, which made it, I do think in a certain aspect, purely geographically, it made it easier since the majority of the internships through CSUB are in Kern County. And we're obviously in, the northernmost part of LA County, but we're still 2 hours away from Bakersfield and where the majority of those internships are. So a lot of the places out here, I was trying very aggressively to intern with the VA, but they were giving me the same runaround that they give the veterans, which I found very disheartening because I was asking to work for them for free and they were still giving me the runaround. So I eventually just gave up on them, looked into some other places out here. There was a place out here that I just simply didn't feel necessarily the most safe doing the internship because of the stuff that they did. There are some other places I just didn't feel were the right fit. So that's where I found the Kern Literacy Council. But it also made it convenient for both myself and the two ladies that I was tutoring because we were able to do it on their own time. The 8-year-old girl, I would tutor her at like 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturdays. Her mom would make her get up and I would tutor her every week. And then the woman who was getting her GED, I was able to tutor her twice a week at night when she got off of work. And then she did ultimately end up getting her GED while I was with her. She kind of realized we were on the last science unit and she realized that she knew a lot of it and decided to just go and take the test and see. And she passed it her first try and got her
Wow.
GED. So that was cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. And so I always encourage students, like it's always a good idea to be active in the community, like with whether it's with internships or club activities, because I think that I think when you go and apply for work, or even you apply for like a master's degree or a master's program, sorry, it's when they see that kind of stuff, it's like it makes you a stronger candidate. Do you feel like that was a similar experience, or did you feel like it didn't really benefit you, or?
I think for me it did because I've also done a lot of other things in the community. As I mentioned earlier, I used to play golf competitively. So I played varsity golf at Fort Sill High School. And then I also played at ABC up until COVID happened. I only got my one season and then COVID happened and kind of took away that second one. But with my private instructor, he actually started a youth golf league out here in Lancaster and Palmdale called the Zero Limits Tour. So when he first started that, myself and my mom would volunteer with him. I would be a rules official, help him set up, help him tear it down, help him hand out the medals. We were there all day with him for every week until I started playing in college and didn't have the time for that anymore because of our weekend matches. But I did that with him. I helped him do some radio commercials for a couple of the local golf courses to try to encourage people to go there. And I also, in my last semester at CSUB, volunteered at the Palmdale Sheriff Station with the secretaries, and I was doing quality checks on police reports. So all of that volunteer work, I think, really built on my resume. It certainly helps me get the job that I have now, especially my experience working with children, both in the golf tour and the tutoring. And I can't say much about the master's program that I'm in now because the school that I'm going to is a very simple application. It's kind of an international school, so there wasn't, I didn't have to get letters of recommendation or anything like that. I just had to give them my transcripts and kind of prove that I was a good student and I didn't need all the other stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Which you are a good student. But yeah, so I have never played a lick of golf. I need to maybe consider it or something like that. It sounds fun, but I've just never taken the time to do it. And so I wanted to circle back around to you had mentioned pursuing a master's degree, but I wanted to step into a little bit about your occupation and what you're doing now. You had mentioned that some of the experiences that you had with your internships and your work experience helped you to get the job that you have now. Can you tell us maybe how that happened and then what your everyday work life looks like, whether it's 9 to 5 or whatever it is?
Yeah, so mine certainly not 9 to 5. Some days I feel like I'm working 24 hours a day because of the nature of it. So my job title is child and family specialist. I work at a local mental health agency that's contracted through Los Angeles County. And essentially what I do is I work on a team of 4 people in a program called Wraparound. This is a program. It's one of the most intense mental health programs that a child can get court ordered to be involved in. Sometimes they're simply just a court ordered to be involved in mental health services and they're referred to us because of specific behaviors. But essentially, the term wraparound was coined in the sense of there's this team of people kind of wrapping their arms around a child and family to help them. So the majority of clients that I work with are in foster care. Every once in a while, we get one that's a legal guardian or an illegal guardianship or very rarely we get one that's been adopted and they use post-adoption funds to keep going with us because we are they have to have full scope Medi-Cal to be with us and we get all of our payment and everything goes through Medi-Cal and Cal-Aim, so they do have to qualify for it in that sense. But typically what happens is most of these children have been abused or exploited in some type of way, whether that's physically, emotionally, sexually. Some of them have been neglected, things like that, and they have some sort of a trauma response as a result of it. So they get a team of 4 people. There is a facilitator. The facilitator's responsibility is primarily to facilitate meetings. We have several different types of meetings that we have with each family and social workers and different people on the teams. So they facilitate those meetings, fill out all the documentation accurately, maintain their charts, stay in constant communication with social workers, stay in communication with the caregivers to make sure that the rest of us are doing what we're supposed to do, see if they need any extra support. They do a whole lot of stuff. Then there is a parent partner, or currently at my office, all we have are their titles are along their certified Medi-Cal peer support specialists. They all had to go get certified because the state's kind of trying to do away with the parent partner job. So they had to go a level up and get an extra certification for it. But essentially, what they do is they work with the foster parents. And then, if there's any family that's involved, whether it's for reunification or even just for visitation, they will try to connect with the family as well. And they'll help with parenting skills, they ensure that they know the coping skills that the children are learning, and just try to help them through the process, help them with anything that they need, help them get into classes, a whole variety of things. The children have a therapist. That one's kind of self-explanatory. It's usually either an associate clinical social worker or a licensed clinical social worker. Every once in a while, there's a marriage and family therapist, either associate or licensed in there, but we primarily have people that have gone and gotten their MSW. Currently at my office, two of the therapists are associate clinical social workers. One of them is a marriage and family therapist intern who will hopefully be getting her associate number soon and coming back to us as an associate marriage or family therapist. So they work with the children on their trauma, processing that trauma and those types of things, and do very minimal behavior things. My position is where all of the kind of behavior management comes in. And there's a very fine line between myself and the therapist because sometimes these children do, for whatever reason, like to talk to their CFS more than they like to talk to their therapist, or maybe they're just a particular day where they really want to talk to one person over the other, or something could come up in a session and they could discuss something with me that I then have to turn over to the therapist. But there's a very fine line there of things I can discuss with them before I'm crossing over into therapist territory. But I'm primarily working with them on coping skills, different behavioral things. If we ever have any children that are on the autism spectrum, I can help them with things like fidget toys. We can help them get an IEP or a 504 plan at school. We do a wide variety of things, and we all work together in tandem as a team to hopefully get these. Our ideal thing to do is that in a matter of a year, which it doesn't always happen this way, but we try to, in the matter of a year, get them to graduate from our program. And typically, in order for them to graduate from our program, what they have to do is essentially be able to handle everything themselves, whether that's the child has learned how to manage their emotions and manage their behaviors, and usually as a team with their foster parents and their biological family, if the biological family is in the picture, they can handle everything themselves now. They don't necessarily need us anymore. And I've been making this joke recently that we're like Nanny McPhee, kind of come in when the kids don't really want us, and then by the time that they really like us, they probably don't need us anymore. It's time for us to go. So that's kind of what we do. Sometimes we have kids that are with us for several years because they're very high risk. We do have children that are suicidal, homicidal, any of those things. We do have to deal with crisis situations. I've had to deal with a number somewhat by myself with the assistance of the therapist just over the phone. The majority of the time, the therapist has to deal with them, but every once in a while, I've had something happen while I've been in a session at their house. And I do go into the field, I see them in their homes, all over Lancaster and Palmdale. We do have a couple of clients that have gone as far as Rosemont or Lake LA, but currently all of mine are in Lancaster and Palmdale. But my experience initially helping with this job, I would say the most in my interview initially, I interviewed with our clinical director. And I think just after hearing my experience and what I did with sociology and kind of my viewpoints on the world and how much I enjoy helping people, it really swayed her, and she kind of hired me the same. She pretty much told me I was getting hired during my interview. It was on a Friday, and then on Monday she officially sent me my hire letter. But they seemed to really enjoy the fact that I did have experience with children in a variety of different aspects, and like I said, my viewpoints on the world that I have from my background in sociology.
That's awesome. And that was actually one of my questions I was going to follow up with, was like, how did you feel like sociology has made an impact on what you do or your occupation? It sounds like, you have some experience with children. You have some insight about, I guess I don't want to assume too much, but did you want to add to that? Like, how has sociology really helped you in your field or in your line of work?
Oh yeah, I can tell you that I use it personally myself day to day. I use it pretty frequently because I'm able to kind of look at different social situations that these kids might be in, and I think I just view it a different way than most of my coworkers do. The majority of my coworkers have backgrounds in psychology. Their bachelor's degrees are in psychology or even in I don't even think we have any right now that are in social work. I think everybody I work with who has a bachelor's degree is in psychology. I'm the only sociology person at my office. So a lot of the time, and this really comes in, we do these things called clinical loops, which we try to do within the first 30 days of getting a new case, which is where the whole team comes together and we look at the entire referral. which has a lot of paperwork in it, and we try to make a plan based on all of the information that we know about the child, their background, the foster parents, any of the biological family, the behaviors that we know about, why they were referred. We try to make inferences about it and plan ahead for how we think we're going to end up helping them, what kind of interventions we might use. And I found myself doing this a couple of times where the psychology people will kind of be analyzing things from a psychology point of view. And I've had to bring up dramaturgy multiple times because we sometimes they just don't see it that the way that because they'll talk about the kids acting different ways in different social situations, and sometimes they just don't understand it. And then I have to bring up dramaturgy and say, look, we also have to look at this from the point of view of that everybody acts different ways in different social situations depending on the people that you're around. And then everybody goes, what's that? And I have to go into a deep dive of what dramaturgy is. But I found myself referencing different sociological theories pretty frequently and explaining them to everybody else. And then kind of seeing everybody go, oh, that makes sense. That's why. And I'm like, yeah, that's why I keep telling you guys. Like, sociology is about social interactions primarily. And that's what we're talking about here is these kids. Social interactions, that's mainly the conversations I bring it up in, is when they're asking, well, why does this kid act this way with, this type of people, or why is he drawn to this group of people? Things like that. And I'll say, well, we have to look at it from this perspective. There's theories about this, and that, and it kind of opens up a whole different world of conversation. And a lot of the time when I've been able to tie together a behavior or something that's happening socially with one of my clients into something that I learned at school, it's able to kind of give the whole team a different perspective. And I think it's been really helpful so far.
Awesome. Yeah, I've had tons of people tell me that, it's there are social factors that influence our daily behaviors or daily lives, and that that can shed light on people's experiences. We won't just we don't just assume, oh, that's just like a unique experience, or I've had some people say they're able to kind of look outside of it and not just kind of place their own experience and say, well, I'm doing well, how come they're not doing well? And it's like we have to explore like the different situations, the different their environment, or like what's how is that playing a part in their life, and maybe influencing their behaviors and stuff like that. So yeah, it's really interesting. I'm glad that you're able to use that and kind of help the children that you work with. And I think that's awesome that you're working with psychologists so you can kind of exchange ideas between each other. So that's really awesome. I wanted to ask about there's this next question is like a two-part question. So it's basically, what are the challenges? I'm sorry, I'll we'll start with the what do you enjoy about your occupation? And then I'll follow that up with maybe what are the challenges? So what is it that you enjoy about your current occupation that you're in?
So this part of my answer is going to sound a little weird, but it'll make sense when I'm done. So part of what I enjoy the most is obviously seeing the progression of the children. I say children, some of them are 18 years old, but they're
The
seeing
children
my clients go from, yeah, they're still children. Seeing them go from maybe having these really severe behaviors or having severe trauma responses to being able to manage it and live more fulfilling, successful lives because of the interventions that we were able to place. And it's always really nice for me, especially when I teach them an intervention and they actually remember it and then tell me that they're using it and their foster parents or biological family are able to tell me, yeah, I saw them using it. They were getting mad and then they stopped and did their deep breathing or one of the other grounding techniques or coping skills that I taught them. That's always very rewarding for me because some of them just simply don't want to do it. And it's kind of a barrier that we have to break through with them. So that's always rewarding for me. Now, here's the part that sounds a little strange. The part that I actually enjoy the most is when there's a crisis. And that's simply because it's kind of like a switch flips in my brain if there's a crisis happening. I don't have to think very much. It's like I suddenly know exactly what to say and what to do. I mean, I've had a 13-year-old screaming at me that, she wants to die and doing all these different things that I can't go too deep into because of HIPAA, but I've had that experience, and I was able to de-escalate her essentially by myself because I was just texting the therapist who lives a couple hours away. And I realized, I think, I mean, part of it's probably a little bit of the adrenaline of those types of situations, but I just find day to day, I see, which then, and this will kind of go back to the question you asked me previously about my schedule. So I, over the summer, it's been a little bit different because the kids haven't been in school, but typically throughout the school year, I have all of my meetings with the team and social workers, things like that, in the mornings. And then when they get out of school is when I go and see them. So I'm getting off at a different time every day, just depending on how many clients I have and how many I'm seeing each day. So currently I have 10, but six of those we are titrating, so I only see them every other week. So I'm kind of, my schedule is a little bit more open at the moment, but I had as many as 17 at one time that I had to see those 5 days of the week. So I'm seeing multiple kids a day, but I'm seeing the kids the same day of the week at the same time every week, unless, something comes up and we have to change it. And for the most part, with, I'd say, a fair amount of them, I'm doing very similar things every time I'm seeing them. So we're talking about coping skills, interventions, how their day was, how school's going, something that they're struggling with. And some of them, especially the older ones, the teenagers, it's really hard to get them invested in a conversation because they think this is stupid. So that's where it gets difficult. And I just find it a little more mundane because I'm essentially doing the same thing every week, just with a different person or different groups of people every day. I'm kind of doing the same things all the time. But a crisis is where it's different and it's unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen. And that's very much sometimes a life or death moment. And you have to be able to make very quick choices. And that's something that I enjoy doing. And then I found I'm very good at. I honestly, I think I'm better at that than I am at the rest of it. The rest of it, half the time, I feel like I don't even know what I'm doing. I have to ask other people. But that's kind of the one moment where I don't have to put much thought into it, and I'm able to just do it. But the most challenging part is sometimes the older ones are kind of so set in their ways that they don't want to change. I've noticed it's a lot better if we can get to them kind of before age 13, 14. We can, if they can get referred to us before they're 13 or 14, I've seen a lot more progress than with the ones that are anywhere between 15 and 18.
Interesting.
Not to say I do have two 15-year-olds right now who are doing excellent, but I have older ones that have been more of a struggle, or they've just been living in the same world for so long that it's the only world that they know, whether it's that they've been on the streets, they've been homeless, they were raised in a gang, those types of things. When they're older and closer to adulthood, it's a lot more challenging to get through to them, get them to listen, to want to participate and engage in the services. Sometimes they're only doing it because they have to, or they do the minimum amount of work that they need to get whatever they're getting out of it, whether it's just that they get to stay in that foster home or to get reunification, or some of them that are 18 are going on to this program called AB12, which is it's a whole separate thing, but it's for children that have been essentially named dependent adults from 18 to 21. They're able to get kind of a monthly allowance from DCFS, live in a home, those types of things, but they have to meet a certain criteria to do it. And one of those is having mental health services. You have to have mental health services and then either have a job or be going to school full time, or they can do both part time. So there's certain criteria that they have to meet. And there unfortunately are some that, because of the age and the life circumstances that they've been through, are only doing what they need to do rather than doing it for themselves. That's the most challenging part of it.
Yeah, having to work with individuals that really aren't invested. Is that kind of like what?
Yeah, because there's, and those are the ones that we often have to tell them, we can't work harder than you because this is for you and you have to put in the work. We can't do everything for you. We can't talk about your trauma for you. We can't practice the interventions for you. You have to actually do the things that we're asking you to do when we're not here in order to make progress and actually graduate from this program. But sometimes it's just a little too late or they're too set in their ways. And then we also do have challenges sometimes with younger kids, especially I'd say if they're under the age of six, even six is pushing it sometimes. They're under the age of six and they have any type of ADHD. It's very difficult to get anything done with them just because they don't have the attention span yet. They're very short attention spans. And getting them to practice something outside of the sessions is very difficult because they just are not old enough for the memory yet. And they're often not old enough to process trauma. And they usually don't even understand it yet. So that's another aspect where it's been more difficult if they're too young. They're just not old enough and they're not ready yet.
You had mentioned that you have them practice things outside of the program. Are those the coping mechanisms that you were referring to?
Yes, I'm sure their therapists have them practice things as well, but that's different from case to case. What I have them practice, and this is also a little different from client to client. Some of them that really need the coping skills or maybe have more severe behaviors, I will ask them and their caregivers, whoever that might be, to practice the coping skills together. Sometimes it's, practice it once a day, 3 times a week. There are some that we ask them to do it 3 times a day. So that way, once they get into a situation where they actually need it, they're able to do it. And especially a lot of the time when they're first learning to use coping skills, it's because maybe they have anger outbursts or tantrums, or they have really low lows where they need to be able to do something to distract themselves or pull them out of it. And a lot of the time, it's essential for the caregivers to know how to do the coping skills and know how to walk them through it. So my favorite one to teach is called Colors of the Rainbow, and it's essentially a coping skill where you look around at the room or the environment that you're in and try to find an object that matches each color of the rainbow. And then I've even told some of the younger ones with their caregivers, if that's not enough, keep it going and play I Spy until it kind of settles down because sometimes they just need more time and those six colors aren't enough time or they find them too quickly, especially if maybe they always tend to get angry in the same room of the house or, have certain things happen, they'll learn how to find things quickly. So I tell them to kind of extend it out and play I Spy. But I'll tell them, okay, well, practice it. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you have a nightmare, look around and try to find stuff that's different colors. Or if you're at the grocery store and you're getting anxiety, look around and find the different colors. But they have to practice it. Their caregivers have to know how to walk them through it, or it'll never work because then they'll never actually use it when they need to.
Interesting. So did you have to learn the coping strategies with the program? Like did was there some training that you had to go through to
You would think, but there was not. So I went through, I didn't go through a little bit of training, but it was kind of like company policy training, such as, our policy on, natural disasters and how to dress. Like for example, they tell us when you apply that it's business casual, but in reality, we almost never dress business casual. We usually dress casual specifically so that we don't look like social workers and we don't look intimidating. We look more relatable. We just wear our normal clothes. But I, being 23, some of the social workers look at me like I'm 12 and I don't know what I'm talking about. So usually when I meet them or I have meetings with them, I dress business casual so that they'll take me more seriously. Something that I found, they really only take me seriously if I'm dressed professionally versus if I'm in shorts and a t-shirt because it's hot outside. They just look at me like I'm some high school kid and what are you doing here? So especially as most of my coworkers are in their mid-30s and up. So they've got 10 plus years on me, most of them, and they've been doing this for a while. And I'm the youngest person at my office as well, so it definitely gives me some challenges in that aspect, but that's really all that the training that was provided by the company was on. We do attend trainings that the Department of Mental Health puts on. We have a little website we can go to and attend those trainings. I've attended the majority of them that they've offered in the last year. There's very few, there's only one that I've missed out on, which is there's a fetal alcohol syndrome training that we're supposed to do within our first year, but they didn't offer it until about 2 months ago, and then it got canceled that day and was rescheduled for a day that I just could not attend. So that's the one training, the key training that we have to do that I'm missing. But I have attended other trainings. Some of them are about suicide prevention. Some of them are specifically about burnout for us as clinicians, how to avoid burnout, things like that. There's a wide variety of them. But the coping skills that I learned were mainly from my coworkers. So, two of our therapists used to do my job, and they are the two that taught me a lot of the coping skills that I know. There is another girl who does my job who's been there, I don't even know how many years. She's been there for a few years, and she taught me some coping skills as well. Some of our pair partners have taught me stuff. So a lot of it has just been learned on the job. When I've gone to somebody and said, "Hey, I don't know what to teach this kid. Here's what's going on," or I'll go to the therapist before I get to the house, call them on the phone and say, "Hey, what should I be working with them on?" I had to do this a lot in the beginning, and now I'm able to just do it on my own and we can figure it out together in the meetings. But in the beginning, I was calling everybody frequently going, "What am I supposed to be doing?" Because nobody really told me.
And that's, I mean, I pretty much had like a similar experience. Like I kind of was just like, I feel like I kind of got thrown into like the being like a sociology instructor, like, but I had some awesome mentors, and it sounds like you have some pretty amazing ones too, that I was able to call almost like on a daily basis and be like, hey, like this is kind of what I'm experiencing, this is what I'm struggling with. Can you help me out? You know? And so it's also a good thing to keep in mind when we start to get better at things, that's when somebody else that comes in that's new, they want that mentorship as well, you know. So it's also good for us to give back as well. But I think that we both have like similar experiences where we're able to kind of call somebody and say, hey, this is what's happening. Can you help me out? And I'm so glad I had it, you know, like a lot of people don't have that, and I think it's kind of a bummer. But I think that really helped me to be a better instructor, and it sounds like it helped you to be better at what you do. So yeah, so that's amazing. And so for somebody that wants to do I guess something similar to what you're doing, I guess can you offer some advice to them, or I guess what would be the number one piece of advice that you would give to them?
Oh gosh, the number one piece of advice I would say is, well, I think it's important to definitely make sure that you're doing something in a community that you're okay working in, especially because a lot of these places you're working out in the field. You need to be okay with that. Not a lot of people are okay with going into other people's homes, especially because in this position, we're not necessarily allowed to defend ourselves in any way, so it can be potentially dangerous. So that is something that people need to keep in mind. But other than that, it's just really important to always ask questions. If you have questions, make sure all your paperwork's done in time, because that can pile up very quickly. And overall, just it's a really good field for somebody that cares about the community and wants to be involved in making the community better. So I would say certainly make sure that you have that type of a mindset, because it can wear on you very fast. You can get burnt out very fast, and it's important to find somewhere where they work as a team, because there are certainly agencies out here that don't necessarily work as a team and you're kind of on your own. So I think it's important to find an agency where you can be on a team of people and have other people to rely on, and have people above you that you can rely on as well and ask questions and get advice if you need to.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's good information. That's good advice. I mean, always having to understand completely what is it that I'm going to be doing, right? Because you have to be okay with it in the first place. And then also being part of a team is also very important. I feel like the same way, you know, it's like that way you don't feel isolated, alone in your experience, and you always have somebody that you can turn to that does have the experience. So yeah, I think that's very helpful. And so you had mentioned that you are going to pursue a master's degree. So I'm very excited for you. So can you tell us a little bit about, because right now you currently just have a bachelor's in sociology and
Yes.
you want to pursue a master's, is it in social work or?
I know this might surprise you a little bit. I'm in my second class right now. I'm about to finish my second class and start my third class. I'm going to Grand Canyon University online, and I'm getting a master's in criminal justice with an emphasis in law enforcement. So I've kind of pivoted a little bit, but it's still related to sociology, and I did take criminal justice classes for my degree. It's a criminology class. I took juvenile delinquency with instructor James White at CSUB. So I've done a few different things because I've always found it interesting. I originally thought of double majoring in sociology and criminal justice, but I decided I valued sleep more than getting two bachelor's degrees at the same time. So I didn't go with that one. But now I've been thinking about getting a master's degree. I took about a year between the bachelor's and starting the master's, almost to the day, actually. It was pretty close between the day that I graduated and the day that I started this master's degree. Is the same month. But I took time because master's degrees are expensive as well, and my job only pays for essentially one class a year, depending on the school that you go to. That's what the amount of money comes out to. It's a little less than $2,000 that they give us, but it has to be related to the job. So they'll essentially only really pay if you want to become a therapist, which I was thinking about initially when I started this job. I was like, okay, I'll go get a master's in social work and I'll become a licensed clinical therapist. And I had this great idea for kind of my own place that I can open up out here. But then once I started working with therapists, I realized I did not want to do that. And it does not look fun at all to me now that I work with them every day. I started and I said, never mind. So I kind of went back and forth because when I was volunteering at the sheriff's station, I was thinking about maybe going into probation. I had a bunch of these different things floating around in my head. And then had to find a new job, started working here, and I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Because this is very much not a career agency. It's like a stepping stone type of agency. Unless you want to be a therapist, then it can be a career place. But if you don't, it kind of stops where you're at. So I looked into it and I talked to a lot of people. I have friends who are law enforcement, family friends, and I've always found mental health interesting. But the one aspect of my job that I don't like is that I am putting myself into potentially dangerous situations and I am legally not allowed to defend myself if my life is threatened in any way, which I'm very uncomfortable with. I don't think that's right, personally. That's just my personal opinion. But I've always thought it would be interesting, and it's kind of my dream to go into law enforcement, specifically to work my way towards the mental health unit. So the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department specifically has a mental health unit called the Mental Evaluation Team. They call it MET for short, MET. And what they do is they show up to mental health calls, whether it's, somebody that's, and usually it's somebody that's being more aggressive than a normal patrol deputies wouldn't be able to handle on their own, a situation that could escalate and become deadly and unfortunate. They respond to those situations. And it's usually a deputy who's been specially trained in pretty much any disability or mental illness that you could imagine. They get training in all of them. They even get training, basic training in crisis negotiation, and they can become crisis negotiators as kind of an offset of this. And they're paired with a licensed clinician from the Department of Mental Health.
I
And
see.
their job, I mean, their primary job is to keep the clinician safe, but they're also there to de-escalate these situations so that they don't become unfortunate and deadly, because there are, as I'm sure everybody knows, far too many situations, especially out here in LA County, where there's somebody who has autism or schizophrenia or any other number of things, and a normal patrol officer isn't necessarily trained to the capacity to be able to handle that situation delicately. And that's where you need the more expertise to ensure that nothing horrible happens. Even though sometimes, unfortunately, that can still be the result regardless, just because of the nature of the situation. But I know that it still needs a lot more work, because there are just simply not enough people who want to do that.
Interesting.
There are a handful of people, but there's not enough people who genuinely want to do that. There's a lot of people that want to complain and criticize it, but not enough people who want to go into it and actually make the difference, because the only way to make the difference is from the inside. You can't make a difference by complaining and criticizing. You have to make a difference by acting on it. So that is kind of my ultimate goal, I hope. You have to, go to the gym and things like that, but my ultimate goal would be to be part of that unit and then actually help make a difference and hopefully minimize those situations that are happening, and help grow that unit. They're trying to turn it into its own bureau, like the detectives bureau, or they might have turned it into one by now, but there's still not enough people, and regular patrol officers in any department need more training on mental illness and disabilities. They get very basic training, and it's still not enough. There needs to be more. And I also just find criminal justice very interesting, learning about the different aspects of it. Especially the thing that draws me the most is learning about how juvenile delinquency and having incarcerated, at least one incarcerated parent, kind of go together. There's a lot of interconnectivities through those that I started to learn about at CSUB. That's kind of what drew me towards it. And Grand Canyon University has two different ways that you can go with it. You can do an emphasis in law enforcement, or they have another one that's more similar to law studies if you want to go to law school and become a lawyer, all those types of things. But I'm doing specifically the law enforcement aspect of it, because it goes into criminal justice and criminal analysis as it relates to law enforcement and different policies and things. So, for example, the class I'm in right now is criminal behavior analysis, and we've looked at it from an aspect of strictly criminal behavior and different patterns in criminal behavior. We've looked at it through victimization theories. That's what we did last week, was about victimization theories and just focused on victims. We're studying psychopathology this week, why people do things such as committing mass murders, serial killers, all of those types of things. And we look at the policies and the legislations that are being put into effect, and it continues on. And we do, there's research classes, all those types of things that are based around the bigger picture, not just looking at the crime part of it.
And there's that definitely sounds like there's a lot of overlap between the sociology and criminology and criminal justice. I definitely think so. Like when I talk to my fellow criminal justice colleagues, we tend to talk about the same stuff. Like for instance, I was actually at jury duty reading. I was reading a book, and it was The New Jim Crow, and somebody in at it's actually a professor at CCB came and sat next to me. She's like, "Oh, that's interesting. I love that book." And so like we started talking about it, and then come to find out we work at the same institution. So yeah, it was really interesting. And we just by talking to her, it was a lot of I feel like there's a lot of overlap between sociology and some other disciplines. So it's very interesting. And then it sounds like what you want to go into is like right up your alley. It's like about de-escalation, it's about crises and stuff like that. When you had mentioned that, that's kind of like you are good at that, and so like that's what you essentially want to do. And can you tell us again what it was. I think it was, I think I caught Met Unit, or what was the
Yeah,
title?
it's called the Mental Evaluation Team, abbreviated as
Okay.
MET. That's what the
Yes.
Los Angeles County Sheriff Department calls them. Every department has their own abbreviation for it, but they all essentially do the same thing. There's other departments like LAPD's is for lack of a better word, a little more mediocre compared to the sheriff's departments. It's a much smaller scale, and versus up here, they're in each area. So there is a MET unit at the Lancaster Sheriff Station, and they respond to everything in Lancaster and Palmdale, and they will even go as far as Santa Clarita if the MET deputies in Santa Clarita are busy and they need help. They'll go drive to Santa Clarita and help out with that. They're in each key area and will respond to the areas and the stations around them. And they're constantly listening to the radio. They have multiple radios that are queued up to the frequency that just reads out the emergency calls, which is what most scanner pages on social media are able to access. And then each station has their own radio frequency, like an inter-station radio frequency. They listen to those as well for all three of the stations up here. And they're listening essentially for something to pop off and that they can respond to, or for somebody to specifically call and ask them for help. And they go immediately. And they're typically in the unmarked white SUVs that you see. And they don't wear their normal uniform either. They wear the green pants, the green cargo pants, and the black boots that you'll see other deputies wearing. But they're usually in a black kind of overshirt, like a button-up shirt. A lot of the time, not even, tucked into their pants or anything. And for the most part, they conceal a lot of their weapons so that they don't look intimidating. There's a lot of people with different disabilities and mental illness are triggered by the uniform and the marked car. So they come in an unmarked car with a clinician and look very, a lot more discreet than a uniformed deputy or maybe a detective who's in a suit. So they look more discreet, more approachable, more friendly, so that they're able to de-escalate those situations. And like I said, they can't even go on and get training and become crisis negotiators. There's even been situations up here that I've been told about where, because the county only has so many dedicated crisis negotiators, and sometimes something might happen up here where we have somebody who has schizophrenia, for example, and is barricaded in a house and they can't get them to come out. But there's stuff going on in LA and all the crisis negotiators are taken up. So they'll call one of the MET deputies who's trained in crisis negotiation and have them essentially hold down the fort until a dedicated crisis negotiator can get up here or until the situation is over.
Okay, interesting. So it still required to kind of be out in the field, be in the environment, and but I think the difference is you can defend yourself at least, or you had mentioned a
Yeah,
couple times. I
that's
should remember
essentially the
what that
difference. Yeah, so at my job, we're not even allowed to have pepper spray because it is considered a liability due to the nature of some of the more high risk clients. Some of them unfortunately do have suicidal ideation, sometimes suicide intent or homicidal ideation or intent. And having pepper spray, even a pocket knife, can be extremely dangerous because even if you have it well hidden, all it takes is for them to knock you down, and they might be able to get a hold of that and hurt somebody else with it. And then it's
I see.
my fault because I had that on my person and I wasn't supposed to. So
Interesting.
that's where it can be dangerous. And unfortunately, there are situations, even in certain neighborhoods, which is where I get a little more nervous because unfortunately, quite a large amount of our foster homes aren't necessarily in the better parts of town. They tend to be in the neighborhoods where maybe there's a lot of gang activity and those types of things, places where it's not exactly safe for a 23-year-old girl to be out when it gets dark. So, especially by myself with, like I said, nothing to defend myself with, walking to my car just can be very dangerous in certain neighborhoods. And unfortunately, some of these kids are actively gang members. And that can become difficult in itself. Some of them are at risk for CSEC, which is commercial sexual exploitation of children. Sometimes their pimps are looking for them. That can be dangerous. There's a number of different situations where it can be dangerous, even with the parents. You know, there could be a man who's 3 times my size that I simply cannot defend myself against with nothing. And that's where it can be dangerous. But if I was a deputy working in that unit, at the very least, I would be doing the same thing that I'm doing now, even a little bit more, and be able to be more involved. But I would also be able to protect myself in those neighborhoods. I wouldn't have to worry so much walking to my car. I also wouldn't be alone ever. I'd always be with other people. There's a lot more ways in which it would, believe it or not, actually be safer for me to work in law enforcement than to be working as a civilian in mental health, just because of the nature of our society these days.
So this sounds like that's one of the motivating factors. And then you said that it's, I guess what you're doing right now, it's kind of like that's the furthest you can go. Is that correct? And so that kind of motivated you to pursue masters as well.
And at the place that I currently work, unless I want to go get a master's in social work and become a therapist, there's really nowhere else that I can go. There's no promotion opportunities unless I want to become a therapist, and even then we would have to have an open spot for a therapist in order for me to go anywhere else, or I would have to go in down to one of our offices in LA. We have one in Gardena, one in Compton, and one that's in Riverside. That covers Riverside County. So it's very slim, or I would have to go to another agency that maybe doesn't pay as much, because my agency is one of the best paying in the area. But it also takes a lot of time. If I were to get the master's degree and go that route, it would take me at the minimum 5 more years until I was a licensed therapist. The master's degree takes about 3 years, and then all of the hours that you have to do for the licensing takes approximately 2 years. And then you still have to take all the exams and those things to become licensed, and that's a much longer amount of time versus I just started my master's degree in May. If I can take, after I complete my third class, I can take multiple classes at a time. If I decide to take 2 classes at a time, I'll be done this upcoming May. And if I keep doing one class at a time, I'll be done October of 2025. So I'll be done with that. And once I'm done with it, I could easily go into law enforcement and basically less than a year later be a deputy. And in a matter of probably 3 years, be where I want to be versus 5 years and a lot of debt.
Yeah, I know that's kind of that's the drawback of everything, right? The debt.
See, and that's the lucky thing. I've been able to go to college without any debt so
That's
far,
awesome.
partly because of COVID. That extra money that they gave us helped out a little bit.
Oh,
But
stimulus checks, yeah.
I was able to get the Cal Grant and the Pell Grant, which helped me both at ADC and CSUB. The COVID money was a little extra money that I was working at CSUB. I essentially made money getting my bachelor's degree. I didn't really pay anything out of pocket. And even
That's
now, because of GCU not having any out-of-state fees, they just have one general fee for everybody because they even have international students. I'm
awesome.
able to get my master's degree for fairly cheap compared to other degrees, and I'm able to pay for it all out of pocket, and I won't have any debt when I'm done. So that's the good part about it, versus if I got another degree, it would be between $80,000 and $90,000 of a loan that I would have to take out, and mine is significantly less than that. So it's a lot better. And I'll also, on the topic of money, I will actually make more money as a deputy than I would make in the mental health field, no matter what position I was in.
Oh,
So
really?
that's another thing, because I have higher education. Without the higher education, there's not those incentives. But because I'll have a master's degree, I'll kind of get a bonus if I decide to do that. So that's another kind of factor into it. I'll be slightly better off financially as well if I go that route.
Well, you were a very strong, excellent student, so I'm not surprised you've researched all this and that you've explored all your options and weighed everything carefully. I always, tell everybody like that are taking out, loans that have to for financial aid or their education is that to really only take out what you need because you do have to pay it back. You know, like I lived with my parents for probably longer than I wanted to, but I was able to kind of only take out what I needed, you know, and I think that was very helpful. And you know, some people come out of college massive debt, you know, and so it's really nice to hear that you're going to be in the clear. You won't have like any long-lasting debt, and that you actually made money as a bachelor's student. So like, very rarely hear that. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I definitely did my research because I initially thought that golf was going to be the only way I could pay for it, and I probably would have gone to a Division I school had COVID not happened, but you know, things changed. So luckily through the grants, the state and federal grants, I was able to do that. And also, I mean, like you mentioned, your parents, I live with my parents and they are awesome, and I've been able to save money. Living at home rather than renting an outrageously expensive apartment somewhere.
Well, Michaela, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate like all the information, all the insight you've given us. You know, I've been wanting to get somebody that has graduated with the bachelor's degree in sociology and is working in the field. I've found many that are working in the field, but they've had their master's degree. So it's good to have some insight on what you could do with the bachelor's degree. I definitely appreciate all the advice you've given everybody. And yeah, I look forward to hearing more about your journey. I mean, we'll have you back on for when you are where you know, where you want to be. It was a mental evaluation team, correct? And so
Yeah,
maybe,
and
yeah, go ahead.
I am definitely looking forward to that. I'm currently trying to become a dispatcher with the Sheriff's Department, so we could probably revisit this multiple times as I get through the different steps.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely love to have you back on. So, good luck with everything and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening. For more stories about sociologists, please subscribe. Until next time.